aging and also some family caregiving and some other things as a play. I'm a proud member of this committee, and it's my pleasure to introduce the first panel this afternoon called The Intersection of Faith and Resilience in Addressing Mental Health and Trauma. Our panelist from the far right is Rabbi Shmuel Silber. And he's the founder and dean of the Institute for Jewish Continuity and also serves as rabbi of Suburban Orthodox Congregation Torah Haim in Baltimore, Maryland. Prior, he was at Suburban Orthodox and was the assistant rabbi of Congregation Shmrei Torah in Fairborn, New Jersey. In the middle is Karen Jordan, who's been a practitioner of Nichiren Buddhism for 36 years. She's a member of the Soka Gakkai International, whose movement dedicated to peace, culture, and education, and is affiliated with the Baltimore chapter in Bowdenville, here in Baltimore City. And on my right is Keith Etheridge, is the Associate Director of the Veterans Affairs National Chaplain Center. During his career, he has received a Legion of Honor Award from the Chapel of the Four Chaplains and was presented with the National Leadership Award by the National Black Chaplains Association in 2011. Please welcome our panel.
You have the PowerPoint, I feel bad. You have the PowerPoint.
You have the mics, right?
No. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to begin really by saying what a privilege it is to be on this panel. You know, thank God I've had the privilege to be part of this program for a couple of years. And obviously, as a member of the clergy, the highlight for me, 5 years. 5 years, wow. And I haven't aged a day. It's incredible. Incredible. For me, of course, as a clergy member, so the ability to discuss really difficult and contemporary issues through the lens of spirituality is always something incredibly amazing. As a rabbi, I try to help people in a lot of difficult situations, many of them which take place, you know, in a healthcare milieu, and so often their spiritual needs or beliefs are not necessarily part of the treatment plan. And I think part of the paradigm that this wonderful event and this wonderful conference has tried to address is a holistic approach to the patient, which of course includes the spiritual and religious beliefs. And it's always wonderful to sit on a panel with such distinguished individuals. And I look forward to hearing your views, your ideas. I wanted to share with you really 3 short points. But I want to give a little bit of an introduction, a little bit of a preface, which is to say, I'm sharing with you my opinions. I know that I'm here to represent the Jewish faith, but I'm not an ambassador of the Jewish people. I'm barely listened to in my own house. So I really am giving you my perspectives. Even within Judaism, we have many different streams and many different opinions, and you know, and each of them have their own approaches to almost everything in Judaism. I am an Orthodox rabbi, and I have a congregation that is comprised of many different people, not all of whom are Orthodox, but clearly that's my training, that's my orientation, that's my belief system. So I'm giving you my insights in terms of how I've dealt with people who have encountered trauma, and what has worked, what hasn't worked. The other piece of introduction that I want to give is that I am not a mental health professional. I'm a rabbi, and I have extensive rabbinic training, some of which was helping people in crisis, but I don't have a psychology background, don't have a psychiatry background, don't have a nursing, social work, or any type of formal education like that. And the reason I say that is because it's very important, because many times people come to me in times of crisis, and I say to them, I'm always happy to listen, but there are certain things which I have to say, you need to see a professional with this. My role is in the realm of spiritual counseling, and very often to be someone who helps direct people in the right direction of getting the help that they need. So some of the things that I want to share with you today are things that help me as a rabbi, hopefully help other people. And there's a lot to say about the world of trauma. And one more word of introduction. You know, it's good when you say it's introduction, then it doesn't count as your time. I do this every Saturday morning with my sermon. Usually, trauma is such an all-encompassing word. And it means so many different things to so many different people. People often come into my office. I'll get a phone call and say, Rabbi, I have an emergency. I have to meet with you. And they'll come to my office. They'll tell me the problem. And my first reaction is, really? That's the emergency? That's the trauma? And you know, we've all heard it in different ways. Sometimes when we grow up and maybe we have a problem or we get upset about something, and very often the refrain that we've heard is, you know, there are children starving in Africa. And the truth is, there's profundity to that because you have to look at your life challenges in context. But we also know that when you have a problem in life, the fact that someone else has a bigger problem does not really address your problem. I know that on any given day, there is someone who is suffering more than me. The world is filled with unimaginable suffering. We know that. But the fact that someone has it more difficult than I do, the fact that someone is experiencing a trauma that is greater than mine, does not solve my problem. So when we speak about trauma, I can say just from a congregational perspective, that word means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You know, the case study that we were looking at today was a real significant, severe trauma. But the truth is, people encounter trauma and look for help in that trauma, and they define trauma in all different ways. So with that, let me make three short points. As an Orthodox Jew, whenever I try to understand or develop an approach to something, the first place I look at is the Torah, is what some might call the Bible, the Old Testament, because we believe that the Torah is divine. God gave us the Bible, and the Bible is the roadmap for everything in life. So whatever problems you have, whatever challenges you have, the good thing about mankind is we don't really change all that much. It's the same problems from 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago to today. They just become a bit more complex with the advent of technology. So we look to the Bible to find. So as preparing for this panel, I thought to myself, where do we find trauma in the Bible? Where do we find trauma in the Old Testament? And there are many different examples of this. But what always jumps out at me is the story of Joseph. So many of us are familiar with the biblical story of Joseph. Jacob and his wives have multiple children, 12 sons altogether. And the Torah, the Bible, records an incredible story of sibling rivalry. Joseph and his brothers do not get along. But to say they don't get along is really minimizing the incredible familial discord. Joseph's brothers want to kill him and stand ready to kill him. They find him alone one day out in the outskirts of the city of Shechem, and they're ready to kill him. One of the brothers intervenes, let's not kill him. But instead what they do is they strip him of his clothing, they strip him of his dignity, they throw him into a pit, and they sell him as a piece of property. Joseph is sold down to Egypt. I'm giving you a little, it's like Sunday school. Right? So Joseph is sold down to Egypt, right? And where he sold to a particular man, has difficult times, difficulty after difficulty. Joseph has a lifetime, really a lifetime. He's sold at the age of 18, and really for the next close to three decades, he just suffers setback after setback after setback, all traumatic. But then something amazing happens. Joseph has two sons. He marries a nice young woman. He has two sons. His two sons were named Menashe and Ephraim. So I'll just give you this in the English. The Torah, the Bible, tells us the meaning of those names. Menashe, because God caused me to forget the suffering of life and the difficulties of my father's household. His second son, Ephraim, God has allowed me to be successful in the land of my affliction. And the commentaries ask a fascinating question. They say, shouldn't the names be reversed? Shouldn't they be reversed? Joseph first says, God caused me to be successful in the land of my affliction. And as a result I have forgotten about my suffering. Generally, the way I forget about my suffering is by supplanting the suffering or eclipsing the suffering with positivity, with forward-moving momentum. But that's not what Joseph says. And the rabbis here learn an incredible lesson. That sometimes, and again, I'm saying this very carefully, understanding that different traumas have to be dealt with in different ways. But sometimes a person has to learn to let go of the pain and move on. Do you know why Joseph was able to be successful? Because he made a conscious decision to, in quotations, forget. Now, he didn't really forget. He didn't really forget, and we see that later on in the biblical stories. But he chose not to make it the dominant aspect of his consciousness. He decided, I cannot categorize myself as a victim. I cannot categorize myself as a survivor. You know, I am, on my mother's side, a first-generation American. My family, most of my family, was wiped out in the Holocaust in World War II. My mother, she should live and be well, was born in the displaced person camps after the war. So my grandparents, who have since passed on, were survivors of the war. Whenever someone referred to my grandmother as a survivor, she always corrected them. She said, I do not like to be referred to as a survivor. Because if you call me a survivor, then that shows that the entirety of my being is that I survived one of the darkest periods in human history. That is true, I did that. But that's not my greatest accomplishment. My greatest accomplishment is that I came to a new country and I made a life. And I had a family. And I got married. And I had children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, all who loved me, revered me. I made a life for myself. I picked myself up. One of the incredible things that we have in Judaism is the notion you can't change your past. You cannot change the difficulties or the trials that life has dealt you. You cannot change who your parents are. You cannot change the home you grew up in. You can't change the people who hurt you or mistreated you. The only thing you can control is what you're going to do with those circumstances. And so I have a choice. I could be a victim. I could say, I'm scarred. And a lot of us are very scarred. I'm scarred. And those scars are just going to haunt me and define me for the rest of my life. Or I can say, no, those scars will always be with me. And no matter how much I try to forget them, I never will. And it's quite possible that every single time I close my eyes, those traumatic events of my life will replay over and over and over. But I refuse to let that define me. I refuse to let that be the dominant narrative of my life. I am capable of doing more than just surviving. I am capable of doing more than just keeping my head above water. I have a lot to give. I have a lot to contribute. I can be like Joseph. Sometimes I have to take the pain and I have to push it back a little bit so that I have the ability to move forward. Another point. The Bible gives us many laws. One of the laws that we have 613 commandments. One of our 600, yeah, it's a lot, I know. One of our 613 commandments is that we are not permitted to hold a grudge. Interesting idea. I'm not permitted to hold a grudge. Exceptionally difficult. Exceptionally difficult. So someone does something wrong to me. Not one of those situations where it's not clear who's right, who's wrong. It's clear who's right and who's wrong. I'm right, the other person's wrong. Another person harmed me. Another person hurt me. So God tells me, I can't hold a grudge. I can't hold a grudge. But you know, it always struck me that God never commands me to forget the hurt that someone has visited upon me. I'm not allowed to hold a grudge, which means that some way, somehow, I have to work through this and understand that what happened to me somehow is necessary for my own personal evolution, but I can't hold a grudge. I can't hold a grudge, but I don't have to forget. Why doesn't God command me just to forget and move on? So the simple answer is because you can't command people to forget things. It doesn't work that way. But I think on a deeper level, God doesn't want us to forget our trauma. Because on a very basic level, when I am hurt by another human being, I know the pain of being hurt. And when I allow myself to feel the pain of being hurt, that informs and shapes the way I interact going forward. If I know what it's like to be hurt, if I know what it's like to be compromised by someone else, I can bring that sensitivity to bear in my other life relationships. And I could use that hurt to be a better father. I could use that hurt to be a better husband. I could use that hurt to be a better friend. I could use that hurt to be a better member of society. God doesn't want me to forget my pain. God wants me to own my pain. Figure out a way to use the pain to be the fuel for self-actualization, the fuel for growth, the fuel to be a whole person. Sometimes our pain breaks us. But if you use pain in the right way, not only does it not have to break you, but it can make you more whole than even others who never experienced any kind of pain. And third lesson, actually from this week's Torah portion, we're reading now in the book of Genesis about the patriarch Isaac. And the patriarch Isaac is perhaps one of the most enigmatic patriarchs for the one simple level that we know, for the one simple detail, we know almost nothing about him. Abraham we know a lot about. Jacob we know a lot about. Isaac we know almost nothing about. In fact, the only thing that the Bible tells us about Isaac is that he dug wells. Okay, I guess that was like a biblical accomplishment, right? He dug wells. He uncovered the wells that his father dug that were filled in, and he dug his own wells. And the rabbis explained something absolutely amazing. Do you know what the art of well digging is? You'll Google it. But well digging is actually a very simple science. What do? You dig, right? You have to take a shovel, and you have to go through layers and layers of dirt. And dirt is not fun. Dirt is unappealing. But if you keep digging and digging and digging, you will find that beautiful spring of water. When people suffer from different traumatic events in life, they often think that they're tarnished, that they're scarred, that they're damaged goods. My job, I often feel, as a rabbi, as a member of the clergy, is to remind people that sometimes the events of life heap a lot of dirt upon us. But just because you're buried beneath layers of dirt does not mean that your wellspring of beautiful and refreshing holiness is gone. It's there. Every person has spiritual beauty. Every person has exceptional holiness. Every single person has that reservoir of waters of holiness and vibrancy that courses through their vein. Just sometimes after years and years and years of dealing with dirt and years and years and years of having difficulties heaped upon you, we forget about the wellspring that is buried below. And it is often the job of clergy, who can't necessarily solve the problems, but to remind people, no matter how much dirt has been heaped upon you, the reservoir of beautiful holy water is still there. The reservoir of beautiful spirituality still courses beneath. So I leave you with these three points. Point number one, we learn from Joseph that sometimes you have to let go of the pain in order to move forward. You can't allow the pain to be the dominant narrative of your life. Otherwise, you can't move forward. Lesson number two, we don't forget our pain, we own our pain. Pain, when you feel pain, it could inform the way you live going forward and inform how you create your life relationships. And lesson number three, no matter how much dirt life has heaped upon you, always remember the beautiful wellspring of vitality, of holiness, of spiritual beauty that courses through your veins. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Anita for inviting me to share a Buddhist perspective on overcoming trauma by building resistance to resilience. And I hope you don't mind, but to keep myself on track, I've written this out, so I keep myself on track. It's been said that Buddhism is a philosophy of hope. This is because its focus is on the irreplaceable value of every human being and on the limitless potential of life. One of Buddhism's closest held convictions is that those who've suffered the most deserve to become the happiest. And people who've experienced trauma certainly rank among those who've suffered the most. Trauma occurs when we experience an immediate and overpowering threat to our existence. This can be a threat to our physical survival, our mental sanity, or our emotional well-being. Significantly, more and more people around the world are suffering from the effects of trauma, caused, for example, by the increasing occurrence of natural disasters. There seem to be two main components of trauma. First, the very core of our self-identity is on some level threatened with humiliation. Second, this threat is so overpowering as to make us feel helpless to effectively respond. Someone has said that the original threat isn't even the biggest suffering. Our feeling that we're helpless to change the situation causes us even greater suffering. To be able to create a resilience response, I feel that we need, first of all, to be able to understand our suffering, to find meaning in the negativity, which threatens to overwhelm us. Next, we need to be able to feel some degree of hope. And finally, we need to be empowered to take the kind of action that's capable of transforming our reality. In order to help open some new paths to understanding, hope, and action, I'd like to share three Buddhist concepts today: transforming karma into mission, accumulating treasures of the heart, and engaging in our human revolution. Buddhism is a teaching of cause and effect. Its aim is to teach us how to make the best possible causes in life in order to experience the best possible effects. The sum of the causes we make through our thoughts, words, and actions is called our karma. The karmic law of cause and effect is seen to operate over the three existences of past, present, and future. A Buddhist writer says, "The contemplation of the Mind Grand Sutra states, if you want to understand the causes that existed in the past, look at the results as they are manifested in the present. And if you want to understand what results will be manifested in the future, look at the causes that exist in the present." Traumatic situations disrupt our belief in cause and effect. On the deepest level, they challenge our sense of what it means to be alive. When something terrible happens to us, we often look within our own lives for a possible cause. If we can't find any, our faith in life and in ourselves can be badly shaken. How can we respond with resilience in such a situation? Older forms of Buddhism took a literal and quite static view of karma. One who stole in this life would be born poor in the next. One who disparaged others would in turn become disrespected, and so on. The idea was that every negative act you commit would have to be paid for at some future point in time. The problem with this mindset is it can make us passive. Especially in the face of unexpected negative life events, we may come to feel like the victims, victims of punishment or of inescapable fate. Newer Buddhism takes a radically different approach to understanding karma. This is called voluntarily assuming the appropriate karma. An even more proactive way of describing this is deliberately creating the appropriate karma. So what does this mean? Did we actually deliberately make negative causes in the past because we wanted or somehow felt we deserved to receive negative effects in the future? Did we plan to become ill, to become addicted, or to become involved in violence? Deliberately creating the appropriate karma means something quite different. It means that in this present moment, we have the opportunity to make a choice. We can choose to view our negative experience simply as unavoidable suffering, or even as punishment. Or we can choose to view them as fuel for transformation, fuel for discovering and manifesting the original power and supreme respectworthiness of our own lives. This is a choice which we have the power to make in this present moment. Again, to use a more proactive expression, we can think of this choice as a vow. Buddhism calls this transforming karma into mission. When we make this choice, we're no longer merely passive sufferers overwhelmed by our circumstances. Instead, we become the protagonists of our own lives. Once we take this stance, the beauty is, not only are we in a position ourselves for a breakthrough, we're able to inspire others to make a breakthrough on their own. The wisdom of the Lotus Sutra says, To simply view your sufferings as karma is backward-looking. We should have the attitude, these are sufferings I took on for the sake of my mission. I vowed to overcome these problems through faith. When we understand this principle of deliberately creating the appropriate karma, our frame of mind is transformed. What we had previously viewed as destiny, we come to see as mission. And I absolutely love this sentence. There is absolutely no way we cannot overcome sufferings that are the result of a vow that we ourselves made. The second point, once we're able to make this shift, we've already built a strong foundation for hope. If we ask where hope is to be found, we could answer that it's found within our own heart. A well-known Buddhist writing says, it is the heart that is important. Another states, more valuable than treasures in the storehouse are the treasures of the body, and the treasures of the heart are the most valuable of all. Strive to accumulate the treasures of the heart. Treasures of the storehouse indicate financial and material assets. Treasures of the body, which here indicates both the body and the mind, include such things as health, our natural abilities, education and training, and so on. While recognizing the importance and value of such treasures, Buddhism puts the greatest value on the treasures of the heart. In Buddhism, heart doesn't mean just our feelings or our emotions. It means the very essence of our life itself. If trauma involves an imminent threat to the very core of our self-identity, accumulating treasures of the heart means to protect, heal, revitalize, and strengthen this core. Recently, I spoke with a Japanese friend about the tsunami which struck Japan in 2011. Thousands of people experienced their physical surroundings being destroyed in an instant. My friend said that what enabled the Japanese people to sustain a strong spirit throughout this ordeal was their profound understanding of the treasures of the heart. Their courageous hope and valiant action in the aftermath of such a natural disaster inspired people around the world. Nichiren, the founder of the Buddhism I practice, wrote, "Life is the foremost of all treasures. It is expounded that even the treasures of the entire major world system cannot equal the value of one's life. Even the treasures that fill the major world system are no substitute for life." In another great writing, Nietzsche says, "A single life is worth more than the major world system." In contemporary terms, a major world system could be equated with a galaxy. How would it change things if we each truly believe that every person's life was more valuable than all the treasures in the galaxy? How would we live differently? One could only imagine the kind of hope-filled impact this would have on our lives. In terms of the self, accumulating treasures of the heart means for us to come to view life itself as our supreme treasure. It means to view other forms of wealth as functioning to support this ultimate treasure, and to be able to make our life choices based on this view. In terms of the community, accumulating treasures of the heart means for us to work together to transform society's tendency to use human beings as a means to an end. It means to establish human beings and human happiness as society's fundamental unit of value. Once we've awakened a sense of hope, the final step towards resilience is to become empowered to take the kind of action that can positively impact our environment. Here I'd like to introduce a contemporary Buddhist concept called human revolution. Whereas the idea of attaining enlightenment can seem a bit remote, the idea of effecting a dramatic change or revolution in an individual's life is something we can all relate to. Buddhism teaches that the most direct way to change our environment is not to try to fix it. That's so counterintuitive, I'm going to repeat that. Buddhism teaches that the most direct way to change our environment is not to try to fix it. It is to transform ourselves. From the Buddhist perspective, this is because it is a dimension of human life which is equal to the universe itself. Anatane Buddhahood in his lifetime reads, "Life at each moment encompasses the body and mind and self and environment of all sentient beings, as well as all insentient beings, including plants, sky, earth, and even the minute particles of dust. Life at each moment permeates the entire realm of phenomena and is revealed in all phenomena. To be awakened to this principle is itself the mutually inclusive relationship of life and each moment and all phenomena. Most of us probably feel that everything from our skin inwards is us, is our own selves. This includes our thoughts and feelings, as well as our physical sensations and movements. We perceive everything on the other side of our skin as being the rest of the world. And I don't know how you feel, but I think it's not hard to realize that the rest of the world is much, much bigger than we are. Buddhism teaches us that instead of feeling threatened by this, we can view our life as a microcosm and the universe as a macrocosm. Not only that, the two are connected. Our life containing the universe, and the universe in turn embracing our life. Especially when confronted with harsh reality like trauma, Buddhism encourages us to turn our gaze inwards, towards the inner universe of the self. Now this self isn't the smaller self we live with each day, the self that walks the dog or cooks dinner. It indicates the greater self, that dimension of our own life which is equivalent to universal life. The purpose of Buddhist practice is to focus on this inner, greater self, to embrace the wisdom that results, and to take fresh, effective action based on this wisdom. This is what we call human revolution. When we do our human revolution, we effectively relocate the source of power from the environment which previously we could not control to our own lives. And this is a game changer. Together with understanding and hope, this kind of determined and innovative action leads to transformation. Armed with a new vision of ourselves, of our relationship to life, and of life itself, we become empowered to create a culture of resilience. I'd like to finish with a quote from Daisaku Ikeda, president of the SGI Buddhist Peace Movement. Today we need a transformation in how society views the human being. When people's view of the human being changes, everything will change. The Lotus Sutra, in effect, contains this message. You must not yoke yourself to nationality or to ethnicity. You must not think of yourself as powerless or as no more than a collection of physical matter. You must not regard yourself as a prisoner of your biological genes. Fundamentally, you have limitless and boundless potential. Fundamentally, the human being is one with the universe. Such is the immense power of one person. Thank you very much.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Well, my job is to facilitate conversation. Actually, I'm grateful to be here to represent the Christian perspective. And I want to start by talking a little bit about my own experience, my own story. I was a young man leaving seminary who was married, newly married, to a woman who was of a different faith tradition and Christian tradition. I decided after participating in a marriage enrichment course with a pastoral counselor and a CD supervisor, any chaplains in the room? Well, those of you who are trained chaplains know what CPE is, Clinical Pastoral Education. I entered in 1983 my first internship in Athens Regional Medical Center, which is the trauma center for the Northeast Georgia area of Georgia, near my home, actually. I was born and raised about 40 miles northeast of Athens. And being the courageous soul I was, I decided that I would volunteer to pull on call, which we did for a week at a time, 24 hours a day, and we had no mentor chaplain to help us with that process. I had no idea what I was about to get myself into. I was so naive. I just did not know. And I, by the way, as a clinical pastoral educator now, would never do this with one of my students. I volunteered to take my first week of on-call in the trauma center. And I saw more trauma in that first week than I had ever experienced in my entire life. I saw children who were involved in horrible accidents. I saw elderly folk who came in with strokes and heart attacks. I saw multiple accidents with college students so mangled that their own friends who tried to identify them misidentified them, and people were notified of deaths when they had the wrong person. I quickly learned that as a chaplain, you can't fix any of that. You cannot fix any of that. And my task was to learn how to be present with those who were suffering in ways that would be meaningful to them. And that means that I had to learn in my Southern Baptist, and I was Southern Baptist at the time, my Southern Baptist tradition, how to sit with folks and facilitate their spiritual needs based on their faith, their belief system, what they needed to do in their culture to process their own grief, and to, in many ways, help prevent others who were so uncomfortable with what was happening that they could not stand to be near it or be around it. And in many cases, even our nurses would want to shut down the grieving of families, and I would have to step in and say, no, this is how they grieve, and I will be with them. I will sit with them in these moments. After 16 units of training, I ended up as a certified educator and went to work and was introduced to a new kind of trauma for me. It was the trauma experienced by military veterans and military service members. I went to work for the Dallas VA Medical Center, and I began to create training programs for the VA there, and quickly realized that most of the chaplains in the VA had no clinical training. There were perhaps a third out of 1,000 that had some clinical training. So I became very invested in trying to help the Department of Veterans Affairs develop a clinical training program nationwide. And fortunately, in 92, I was offered the opportunity to move to the National Chaplain Center and to help create the clinical training programs for VA chaplains across the nation. Today we have about 38, very sometimes 40 programs, and we have 153 residency programs across the United States. And in those programs, we focus very much attention on the interdisciplinary work that we do with healthcare providers, particularly with our nurses and with our psychologists and our social work colleagues. We certainly work with the other members of the medical teams, our physicians and others. In fact, if you look at much of the research that's being done today about spirituality and wellness or wholeness, it's done by the psychologists and the psychiatrists. We as chaplains need to learn the art of research, and I am not a researcher, but I have great admiration for researchers. My experience in Dallas and then later at the National Chaplain Center helped me understand and have a vision for why it is important for chaplains as spiritual care providers to work and to have this critical intersection between chaplaincy and mental health. In 2009, 8 years after 9/11, we were seeing large numbers of service members returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The numbers of suicides were going up around the country. And in those days, the president called for the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs to have a national summit to determine a strategy for moving forward to address the increased numbers of behavioral health issues that our service members and veterans were facing, the increased numbers of suicides that were happening, and even today we have on average 20 suicides by veterans 18% of the suicides that occur in America are of veterans. It continues to be an issue that we have to find ways to address. The summit was like nothing I had experienced before. For the very first time, chaplains, local clergy, persons of many different faith traditions were all invited. Counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, theologians, all at the same conference, at the same table, doing exactly what we're doing here, talking together about the intersection of spirituality, of health, of wellness, and the understanding that we must have from each other's unique professional expertise and specialty areas to work together to collaborate and help. Out of that experience, we in the Department of Veterans Affairs created a program and an office, actually, that stands separate and apart from our National Chaplain Center called Mental Health and Chaplaincy. And we ended up surveying a large number of chaplains, and I did have a PowerPoint with this on it, but I decided not to use it, obviously. We surveyed a chaplain from the military and across the VA, had a tremendous response from them, and out of that we determined that we could develop a certification program that is a year-long program for training chaplains to work specifically as members of interdisciplinary teams in mental health across the nation. So our curriculum focuses on the logic of why we should do this important work. It looks particularly and does provide an overview of the DSM-5, and then we focus on three very specific evidence-based practices: acceptance commitment therapy, which focuses on accepting the experience of the individual where they are, and identifying values that are important to them, and then moving forward with creative actions that can help them create a new life of their own. Motivational interviewing, which has been used by substance use treatment programs for many, many years, and is a phenomenally close process in training, at least, to what we have been using for years as ACPE supervisors. And the last evidence-based practice is problem-solving therapy. That program is now in its fourth year. We are training 20 VA and 20 DOD chaplains every year, and the big focus of that certainly is on issues related to PTSD, suicide prevention, suicide awareness, and moral injury, which was mentioned several times today, and thank you for addressing it in your comments. Moral injury is huge. As we begin to understand how, in the VA context, soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen are finding themselves in situations in combat where their heart tells them one thing because of their own values that they've grown up with, and their commanders and others order them to do another thing that is right to protect and take care of your own service buddies that are beside you and to fulfill the mission. And the horrors of repeated injury because, for example, my son-in-law, who is a warrant officer in the Army, has been deployed 7 times to Iraq or Afghanistan. So the repeated deployments add to the multiple traumatic experiences that they have, and they are all unique. So understanding this has been important for us, and working collaboratively so that we know how to actually engage and make referrals is critical. I don't have a lot of time left, so I'm going to shift my thinking now to, so what about this intersection between spirituality, faith, and mental health? Paul Tillich talks about spiritual life functions. And in his first volume of his Systematic Theology, he identifies three spiritual life functions. The first has to do with identity. It's about self-integration. It is the process for an individual, a person, for us to know who we are in relation to other persons. Developmentally, as we are born into this world, we are connected to other people from the beginning. And through our experiences in life, we form an understanding of ourselves in relation to these other people. That is not just a spiritual process. It is not just a spiritual issue. It is certainly a psychological issue. It is the business of understanding the psyche from the mental health profession perspective. So we overlap them. The second one has to do with self-creativity. Self-creativity has to do with what we do with the energy of life. I used to do a spirituality talk with newly diagnosed PTSD patients, and I would tease them as they were, you know, in this room, and I thought I was going to have 15. I had like 75. And I would say, I know you got up this morning and you just decided, oh, I feel so great. I'm just going to go down there and hear Chaplain Everett talk down at the VA because, hey, this is a wonderful day. Well, they didn't. Obviously, I was poking fun at the reality that these folks are suffering greatly. But they did something to make themselves hopefully better. And the doing something was literally getting out of bed, getting themselves to the VA when it wasn't easy to do, and forcing themselves to sit in an audience where, by and large, everything in their being was saying, I cannot be with these people because I need to isolate myself because of the experience that trauma is having in my own life. That's powerful. The power to choose to do. The last one is self-transcendence. That has to do with meaning. Given our freedom and destiny, we make choices about who we are, and we do that based on the stories we tell ourselves about who we are. And it involves the other two. Self-transcendence involves identity as well as finding meaning and purpose in our life. These three aspects overlap in my thinking between this intersection between faith and mental health and resilience. The last thing I'll mention is moving to the Christian tradition and the Christian experience. We cannot understand the Christian scriptures unless we first understand that the Christian religion was forged, if you will, in the fires of trauma, beginning with Jesus' arrest, his flogging, his crucifixion, and what took place after. If you think about all of the Christian scriptures, beginning with the first ones that were written by the Apostle Paul, Thessalonians addresses this very issue of how can we remain when now even those who believe are dying away? How can we remain in the presence of the persecution that is happening in Christian community by the Romans and others? How can we exist and go forward? When you look at what happened with Jesus' followers who penned all of these scriptures, for example, look at John Mark and Mark's gospel. John Mark was the associate of the Apostle Peter. And Peter was imprisoned in Rome, most likely, when John Mark penned the Gospel of Mark. And he has two purposes in penning that gospel. One is to proclaim the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ. He's not Jesus of Nazareth. It's not Jesus, the Christ, the Messiah. It is Jesus Christ. It's as if that's his name. Son of God is what he says. So he is witnessing in the sense that his intent is to proclaim the gospel, the good news, and to convert. The other purpose of it is to literally speak hope to the Christian community who remain. And those who remain are quite literally the believers in those small churches. So you have the aspect of all of those Christian writings addressing the sustainment of Christian believers in times of persecution and trial. Paul writes Philippians from a jail cell, most likely in Rome or Ephesus. When you look at all of those disciples, the only one that survives and dies a natural death, as far as we know, was John the Beloved. He died on the Isle of Patmos, a prisoner, exiled by the Roman government. All the rest were martyred. And the experience of the Christian community in the context for 300 years was that of persecution. It's only after Constantine becomes the emperor that Christianity becomes recognized and exists without persecution. We don't read the Christian scriptures in our churches these days with that set of trauma-informed awareness. But we should. So that's our issue as clergy, and that's why we in VA have started another program that's called our Community Clergy Training Program. We have last year trained over 3,000 community clergy and community leaders of all faith traditions regarding the needs of our returning warriors, the understanding of what our program basically has four modules: military culture and the wounds of war, pastoral care with veterans and their families, mental health resources and making referrals, and the fourth has to do with building partnerships and supporting through networking. Those programs are ongoing, and we hope and pray it will continue. And my time is up, so I'll quit.
Take one mic and you can share one.
We have time now, again, three concepts here. Comments, reflections, or questions.
One specific question that I have is, I work at a drug and alcohol mental health facility, and it took a long time for myself as a mental health therapist to incorporate the idea of therapy into addictions counseling. One of the issues that I think we continue to see in some of our therapists struggle with is when clients say, let go and let God. And we're trying to help clients, and everything that we talked about today is giving people that self, ability to take control over the trauma that they experience. So how would you respond to a statement like that when clients are turning to their religion for an answer and not taking the action themselves.
There are certainly, that can mean different things to different people, but if that is an avoidance behavior on the part of a patient, then it needs to be understood as that. And to talk that out, you know, so what does letting go and letting God mean? If you look at acceptance-dependent therapy, accepting your condition and that and identifying your most important values may be a great thing to do, but it doesn't mean that you would ignore or continue behavior that can be destructive to you. So it is not an either-and answer here. It's a, you know, faith and the resources we have in faith, no matter what your faith tradition, can be a wonderful help to people who are suffering addictions. But it is not typically the only answer. You have issues related to grief and loss that have to be addressed. You have issues beginning with the physical dependence of the body on whatever the drug of choice is. And if you ignore that, you know, you will see with alcoholics, for example, not only DTs, but you will see the possibility of death as a result of it. So you have to have the medical intervention. Chaplains should be working with our healthcare providers in those contexts to understand, so, you know, what is it that they're really saying? What does it mean? And so that dialogue, I think, becomes really important.
Anybody else?
Yeah. I mean, we don't believe in let go, let God. That's the simple answer, meaning that from a Jewish faith-based tradition, we believe that God's efforts begin where man's efforts end. That if I want God to help me, I must do everything in my power to help myself. And to go ahead and to kind of shirk my personal responsibility and just say, God, you take care of it, unfortunately, that's not spirituality. It might just be a bit of laziness or recalcitrance to go ahead and encounter or really embrace what it is that I have to do. And I think what the Reverend said is very important. There is a very fine line between using God as a support and using God as an excuse. God as a support is the most incredible thing. No matter how difficult your journey is, God is going to be by your side every step of the way. And he'll walk with you, but if you're not taking a step, he's not taking a step either. That's what it means to use God as a support. The journey is going to be hard, and I don't have to do it by myself. I have someone or something to lean on. But to expect God to do the heavy lifting when I'm not going to do anything, then unfortunately that might just be a person looking for an out.
That's really interesting, because Buddhism sort of harmonizes the two views that goes back to the microcosm and the macrocosm. We're all human, and I think we all have the tendency to work really hard to do the things that are really not our business to work on, while we're very busy self-neglecting simultaneously. That's a matter of experience and wisdom. So in Buddhism, when you set a goal or a prayer that I really want to achieve, say it's overcoming an addiction, and then you chant for wisdom, you pray for wisdom, you take action based on that wisdom, but you let go of exactly how, when, da-da-da-da-da, all the details of how the universe is going to partner with you. Because if you start giving orders to the universe, in that sense, I mean, good luck to you. How can the universe play its macrocosmic role? They say the Buddha is the great universal life. If you're trying to do that yourself, first of all, it's not going to work, and second of all, you're closing the door. It cannot respond to your change, so that inner transformation. So we have, I don't think of us, we're kind of like the little hobbits in their little hobbit houses. We don't really want to be bothered. We want to stay in smoking our hobbit pipes and this and this, and it takes a really great crisis to push us out of our hobbit mode, because we really like to self-neglect and try to run the world, including everybody else. How we want them to treat us, how we want our circumstances to be, how we want the weather to be. We waste so much energy in trying to control external reality, instead of, when a crisis happens, looking inwards, doing our work, and then receiving the protection of the universe in response to our doing our work.
So thank you so much for sharing. One of the things I see commonly in medical facilities, I'm a nurse, and with other nurses, with providers, with other caretakers, we have patients and clients that are struggling with trauma. And they are not at a point of enlightenment or ready to step forward to make that change. And what I struggle with is what I see is people say, okay, they're not going to do it, then forget that. You know, or, you know, they're not going to make the effort, so I'm not going to make that effort, you know, which is wrong. Or just feel frustrated or burnt out because they feel like, you know, I've done all this, and look, they're not even following through. Without really recognizing or taking a step back, you know, we talk about, you know, the developmental level that that person may even be in due to the age of the trauma and what happened. I guess I'm looking for words of wisdom of how do we help our fellow caregivers maintain and retain that passion and spirituality that should be brought to giving care to the people that we're there to serve.
Wow.
Sudden brave soul music. Well, I think that compassion fatigue is, I think, what you're talking about, is indeed rampant among all of our healthcare facilities these days. And finding ways that we as colleagues can provide support, moral support, if you will, professional ongoing efforts to care for ourselves is absolutely essential. Again, I'll do a little self-revealing here. I had a heart attack in 2013. I have no heart disease in my family. You know, and when I look back at my lifestyle, it was pushing myself beyond where I should have been and burning out because I was so passionate about the programs and the things that I believed in, you know, not just at work, but in my local congregation. I mean, it's in my family. It's like, okay, when do you ever stop to take care of yourself? And I really had to do some soul searching about that. So it begins with our very nature, I think, is as, you know, Tillich says, you know, we help ourselves and we benefit from the help we provide for others. I mean, that's absolutely true. But we also have to do our part to understand that we can't do it all. The flip of that is sometimes we think that we as the professionals are the ones who have to do the intervention. And Larry Dawsey has a book entitled War and Redemption, where he talks about his work with Vietnam veterans suffering with PTSD. And he talks about all the interventions, all the medical treatments, you know, all the various, everything from, you know, the cognitive behavioral therapies and the psychoanalytic therapies. And the thing he comes back to finally in his book, he says, you know what helps the most? He says, first off, it's not the symptoms of PTSD. It's really, and he doesn't call it moral injury, but he identifies it as moral injury. It's the fact that these folks are still struggling with the issue that they were involved with killing another human being, witnessing the death and the horrors of war, and surviving when their buddies did not. So survival guilt. Those are the big issues. And he said the people who address and help that the most are peers. People who are peers who can, in community, a very small peer group, but community, share the experience together and to talk and hold those sacred stories within that community. From, again, I'll go back to our Christian roots, for those who may be Christian in here, we share in communion something in our Christian community, our relationship one with another, in the sacraments, in the experience of even having, you know, my church has Wednesday night suppers. Well, a part of that experience is a sharing of community and our shared story. And there's healing in that. These experiences may not have anything to do with religion, but the ritual of it and the sacredness of it by these peers has great healing power. And I would encourage you to look at Larry Dossey's new book on war and redemption.
Buddhism talks about 10 life conditions, that at any moment in life we're in one of these 10 life conditions, and it contains everything from hellish suffering to the enlightenment to Buddha. And one of these life conditions is called the Bodhisattva. And frankly, from what I've been hearing today, all the care you're extending to your patients, to your colleagues, to your students, to your clients, to your family, you are actually already, what Buddhism would say, you are already walking the Bodhisattva path in a way. So I'm going to give you an answer to your question. You're asking a question about the Bodhisattva life condition, basically, the life condition to help others. And they say there are two pitfalls to that life condition. One you actually addressed earlier in the role playing, when someone feels, when they're helping someone, that they're somehow better than that person. If a person is handicapped and you're not, and you're helping them, it's really easy to think that you're superior because you can walk and they can't or whatever. You fall into that mindset of arrogance. And funny enough, that's one danger of this Bodhisattva path. But it doesn't sound to me like you're anywhere close to that danger. It's the other side, the burnout side. The other danger of the Bodhisattva path is to self-sacrifice, to self-neglect in a way that's incorrect. So Buddhism talks about practice for self and others. It's literally inseparable. If I light a lamp on a path for myself so I can walk safely, anyone who's walking with me, their path is also lit. So that comes down to your wisdom. First of all, I would say you're fantastic for wanting to care for your patients like that and not give up on them. And not only that, you want to encourage your colleagues to keep their life condition high so they can do the same thing. So that's already fantastic. Same time, you have to trust your instinct. You're feeling burnout. You're feeling their burnout. You sense the danger. So when you know you found that balance of practice for self and others is when you know that the care you take for yourself, whatever care you're taking, whether it's spiritual, physical, financial, whatever way you can best take care of yourself and live with joy, that will bring back to your patients. And conversely, the most you exert yourself to help them, you will be enriched. When that balance is thrown out, you will feel it instantly. That's when you feel burnout. That's when they won't listen to you. You can feel that. So it's a matter of balancing that path and having the confidence. Buddhism teaches there are separate people. There's no difference between you and me. So whatever I do for my own benefit in my life is for you. And anything I do to help you helps me. And that only gets thrown out of balance when we're doing something that's either arrogant or self-sacrificial. And you can trust yourself. You'll know instantly. But I have to say, I want to applaud you for even having that question. I think it's wonderful. So thank you.
To maybe focus a bit more in terms of how you influence, let's say, fellow caregivers. So I think we would all agree, you really can't change anyone. The only thing you can do in life is model the right kind of behavior. Even anyone as a parent knows, your kids remember very little of what you say, but remember everything of what you do. And so successful parenting is much less speeches, much more dynamic, positive actions. And the truth is, it's the same thing with anything in life. I remember that when I was first starting in the rabbinate a long time ago, I went to visit one of my older congregants. He was a 99-year-old man who was in the hospital for just old age. It was his final days, and I found him. This was late on a Saturday night. I think I told this story maybe in our first conference when we were speaking about end-of-life care. I found him shivering under his covers. So he told me that he rung for assistance a couple of times. The nurses kept bringing him covers, and one of the nurses told me he needs a transfusion. So I found the doctor on call, and I said, again, I was much younger and probably a bit more brash and arrogant. I said, when are you doing the transfusion? So after that initial look of disdain, like, who are you? He said to me, listen, transfusion is not going to help this guy one way or the other. So whether it happens now or it happens in an hour from now, it's not going to make a difference. And I was so appalled by that. Because I said to the doctor, I understand you're not going to cure this person. He's suffering from mortality. I got it. His day is going to come just like all of us. But you have the opportunity to make a qualitative difference in another human being's life right now. Was that doctor a bad person? God forbid. Was he callous? Absolutely not. He probably was coming off a 24-hour shift or whatever else it was on call and was profoundly exhausted. And when you're exhausted, it wears down every aspect of your persona. What I probably didn't accomplish that night, because my demeanor wasn't correct, is I could have influenced him. I could have shown that by me coming to visit this man late on a Saturday night, because I care, and maybe my caring would have rubbed off on him, maybe not. I didn't handle it the right way because I was young and inexperienced. But I think if you want to make a difference anywhere in life, it's not as much about what you're going to say, but it's much more about what you're going to do. Model the right type of compassionate and empathic behavior, and some way, somehow, it will have positive ripple effects.
I wanted to get back to one comment that you made about chaplaincy and clergy not using data and research. And I guess the obvious answer as to why you don't do that is because you have to take things on faith. But given the fact that that spirituality and spiritual practices have a great deal to offer people, and the fact that organized religion has proven itself to maybe not always be worthy of people's trust, what are the things that keep clergy and chaplain efforts from working together to do research?
Thank you for your question, Matt. I think it has been more of our tradition in terms of what we've learned in our theological training. The kind of research that I have a psychology undergraduate degree, and I was introduced to research as part of that degree requirement. That's not true for many, many clergy, so they don't have the same appreciation for what we would call quantitative research. They may have some interest in qualitative research. That is changing. There are programs now that are sponsored by the Association of Professional Chaplains, by the Association of Clinical Pastoral Education, that focus specifically on research and training young chaplains, young as in experience, not necessarily in age, to learn about research and to partner with other disciplines to be engaged in research. And I've been very fortunate to have experienced some of this in my own career with dear, dear colleagues, and I'm doing my best right now to try and hire a researcher for our national office. In fact, I was communicating with him during the lecture, suggesting ways we might be able to get him on board. I really believe it, and I think it's important.
Thank you.
don't actually have a, I mean, you're free to respond, but we also have a couple of questions. So if you would like to respond, you can, or we can go to Warren.
I'm a pretty empathetic person, but I don't think I was necessarily that way early in my career. And I think it's important to put yourself in the position that if you're treating someone to look as though at least understanding what they're going through and that you're going to do the same thing and to be empathetic. Back early in my training, there was a book called The House of God. It was an intern at a major hospital in Boston. You can guess what the House of God was. And there was one term that they used, which is horrible, and I never used it. Go or get out of my emergency room. Judaism, there's no such thing as perfectionism. Christian, but I will say, for a year I worked in an emergency room. And there was someone who kept coming back, depression, suicide attempt, overdose, you put them to the new charcoal, you, whatever you have to do. And although I never used that term, I started feeling that way. Again, the confession part is I felt a major depression, and I looked back on that and said, how could I have said that, how could I have acted or felt that way? So that's about the one. I looked at each individual that I was caring for, each particular time, whether they came to the emergency room, they came to the office frequently, as though I had their problem, and I'll admit that.
I think that's wonderful. I should tell. So I was not going to tell no medical story or medical people, but recently I went to the doctor for a checkup. It's kind of funny. And at one point he says to me, "Bitter kitty kitty," and he leans over. I love my doctor. Don't get me wrong, but he leans over and said, "I'm afraid there's something really, 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 really wrong with your heart. Your EKG is completely abnormal." I mean, it looked like something off. It looked like I'd never seen any EKG like this in my life. Now, talk about trauma. So, of course, my pulse starts, you know, and my blood pressure, and this is, turns out, they just mixed up two cords in the EKG. So the two wires were crossed, and so I got this hat, and it looked like I was a Martian or something. So the doctor took my blood pressure right after that, after they turned, found out there was nothing wrong, and then he says to me, "I'm worried, you seem to have high blood pressure." Now, so I didn't even try to explain it to him, but I'm quite serious. If I can go to a doctor who has that degree of empathy, that's the goal, in my opinion. That's the goal.
I think we have time for one more comment, and then we'll move to our final session.
My question is whether or not you first experience or have to present to you the experience after the long-term, after the spiritual trauma, and how you may have interacted or supported that person through that. This question is coming from a lot that I see with members of the LGBTQ community who have been significantly hurt by their community members in their faith, as well as leaders of the faith, especially the impact of social media and how ever-present that is in our lives. So yeah, we've worked with members who experience that and have to go out from that.
I think that's an incredible question. I mean, I have had situations of people who have been abused by members of the spiritual community. And the truth is, sometimes I'm able to help, sometimes I'm not. Sometimes they'll come to me because a lot of times for all their past life problems, their first address was a rabbi. But when that harm and that hurt has been perpetrated by a member of the clergy, they show up and they say, "You know what? I can't do this." Which, and the truth is, who could fault someone after suffering abuse at the hands of someone who is supposed to represent safety, security, spirituality, be an ambassador of God, and someone abuse that power to compromise and to hurt another human being, you can never fault a person like that for losing all faith in men and women of the cloth, or men and women of clergy. What I often try to tell people, and I think kind of when we take a step back, is the same way that if someone perpetrated a crime against me, and that person looked a certain way, was of a particular race, ethnicity, or religion, it would be wrong of me to condemn all members of that same race, ethnicity, or religion as being all of that same ilk. That would be wrong. Sometimes you have to try to do that same thing with religion. There are a lot of really wonderful men and women in religious positions who, as Durbin said before, hopefully not to the point of heart attack, but give of themselves selflessly to their flocks. So there's that fine balance. I often feel that my role is just as a listener, and then to try to figure out how to get people to the professionals they need to get to in order to get the help that they need. And in many times, other times, if the problem is quote unquote less complex, maybe I'll be able to help them work through it on their own. But I have often found that in situations where people have been abused by members of organized religion, my role often has been to listen, to try to convince them not to lose their faith in God. Because to me, if you don't like rabbis, it's okay. You don't have to like rabbis. You don't like priests, you don't have to like priests. But don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Because God always has a lot to offer you, even if sometimes his servants haven't done good by you.
Thank you for your words.